when the governments think about it, and that's where the debt sustainability ratio, when people talk about debt to GDP, remember that both are moving parts. So long as your GDP is likely to keep growing, governments can keep on taking more debt so long as their ratio is under control, right? Because the government is potentially for forever. Debt is, according to some people, a bigger innovation than even the wheel. Debt, I would say, on the whole, is the reason that it has lasted at least 5,000-6,000 years. If it was not productive, it was not good for human society, it would have withered away.
Right.
So I think it is good. When it becomes bad is when it becomes unsustainable, and then it starts to stress the very fragment or the very forces that hold society together.
Right.
Which is trust. Because the government, because you know, you're effectively spending other people's money.
Right.
There's also a tendency to be a bit casual about it.
Yes.
Right. That I will free bus ride to someone, or this train ride is now free. Now, all of that may not be the best and productive use of capital. So there needs to be caps on what the government can spend.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Open Dialogue by Axis Bank. Today we cover a very interesting topic, which is on debt. It's estimated that as of middle of 2023, the total global debt stands at about $307 trillion. And the global debt to GDP ratio is upwards of 300%, which means that the world has borrowed three times its annual income already. What is debt? What are the implications of debt? Is it good? Is it bad? Can it be a catalyst for growth? Or is it a time bomb in the ticking? We discuss these topics today. Joining me today is Neelkant. Neelkant Mishra is the chief economist at Axis Bank. And he needs no introduction. He's been on our show multiple times. So we'll get directly into the conversation. Neelkant, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here again.
So Neelkant, before we get into kind of more tactical questions, let's just take a big step back and just talk to us about what is debt and what is its history, where did it originate, and you know how it's worked out.
Debt is, according to some people, a bigger innovation than even the wheel.
Okay.
In terms of the impact it has had on human society and how we've developed. So it's as good as if I have some surplus and you have a deficit, or if you can put my surplus to better use than I can, then I give it to you.
Right.
And so debt, while of course now we think of it as money being transferred, earlier it could be that you had a year of drought and someone had surplus grains. Allowing people to survive through the drought would have kept the population intact. It was in everyone's interest for that to happen. And whenever then you had a surplus crop, you went and repaid it. The acceptance of debt has also, so as it became slightly more monetary, there was a lot of philosophical debate around it. So over and above, you know, things which are philosophical in nature, like, you know, in Hindu scriptures, they talk about the rind, right? That pitri rind, like, you know, the fact that your parents brought you up, you have to pass it on. And there are debts which carry on for multiple generations, which can be actually monetary in nature as well. So in a way, debt is something which has been studied philosophically and very deeply over generations and over millennia. And in the early days, there was a sense that this was sinful, that lending and charging interest on something was a sin, though lending by itself was not sort of frowned upon. But then that was only when the rich were lending to the poor, when banks emerged and the savers, the small savers, were pooling their savings into banks, and then the banks were lending to large corporates or aristocracy. The religion the religious views on interest then got diluted. So basically, allowing people to get returns for providing their savings to someone became much more socially acceptable. One last point. So remember that this $307 trillion of debt is debt for some entities. Could be individuals, the governments, or corporations. But they're also assets for another set of people. Mm-hmm. And they could be, again, corporations or individuals, usually not governments. So, which is one of the reasons why the ratio can be much higher and still be sustainable. Because for some people, it is a way to deploy their excess savings. And other people can actually use it more productively.
No, fantastic. So, so if I were to just paraphrase Neelkanth, basically, let's say I have a farm and I am unable to farm it because I don't have a bullock maybe, and you have some extra money. If you give me that money, I can, you know, maybe rent or buy one and, you know, till my farm, some produce comes out, I sell it. I can pass on some of that to you, keep the rest for myself. You are better off, I am better off, and the economy is better off.
Correct.
And so debt in that way is a great way for the economic productivity to go up significantly, because productive assets get deployed at productive points versus,
correct,
you know, staying in your safe, as an example.
Correct.
In which case, you wouldn't have gotten the return, I wouldn't have had my farm, and you know, the economy would have been worse off. And the second point you made is that this notion of interest being kind of quote unquote unholy sin,
yes,
sin, which by the way continues in some religions even now.
Yes.
But that changed at the time when the rich started to borrow, because then even religions looked at it as saying, look, it's the kind of the rich guy paying the poor guy, so it's a social benefit versus,
yes, exactly,
usury, which would have been the other way. So very fascinating, and I think the history of debt itself is quite fascinating, right? So let's move on a little bit to now, you know, like, is debt good or bad, or is there a prism that you can look at it, or, you know, is there context to it?
So that's where, you know, the philosophical view of whether is it something that you are taking on for consumption or for investment. What are you taking it for?
Right.
Right. And how productive is it? So, if you are, and in some cases, even taking debt for consumption is also better for everyone else.
Right.
Right. So long as you have the ability to repay it.
Right.
Debt, I would say, on the whole, is the reason that it has lasted at least 5,000-6,000 years if it was not productive, it was not good for human society, would have withered away.
Right.
So I think it is good. When it becomes bad is when it becomes unsustainable. And then it starts to stress the very fragment or the very forces that hold society together.
Right.
Which is trust. So the moment, you know, some entity, whether it is government or a corporation or an individual, takes on more debt than they can sustain, the point at which the realization dawns on everyone that that debt is unsustainable is a very stressful point for society. And which is why you will see that over a period of time, as we've, as our society, as our economy has globalized, global economy is much more interconnected, as we have learned how to handle a rapidly growing financial system, the focus on debt to GDP ratios, I mean, the 300% that you started off with, that focus on debt sustainability has become much more important. So long as the debt is sustainable and is repayable and everyone believes it is repayable, I think debt is good.
Right. So you use this word sustainable in this context. So what is sustainable, and kind of how do you decide, or how do you define that something is sustainable, debt in this case is sustainable, or has it reached unsustainable levels?
So, like what we do in our banks, right? So, we look at debt service coverage ratios, right?
Right.
So, if the cost of servicing the debt, so if I earn 100 rupees, I have, say, 50 rupees of surplus, So 50 rupees I spend, 50 rupees is my surplus. And if I take on a debt where the principal and interest payments are 20 or 30 rupees, then it is serviceable. So right. In case, even if my income was to fall by 20-25%, I will still be able to service the debt. So there is a sufficient amount of cushion. And that I can sustain this for the period. So if I say take a 100-year loan, of course I can't take a 100-year loan, right? Because I may not survive that long. So when you think about sustainability, you have to think about not just current income, but future incomes. So sometimes what can happen is, like what happened during the previous decade, that your say steel company's EBITDA per ton was $300. On that EBITDA, they took on debt, which was say 2.5-3 times debt EBITDA. Suddenly the EBITDA per ton fell to $100 or $80. And then the debt EBITDA ratio went to 8 or 9 times. And then the debt became unsustainable. So, one, the sustainability can change over time. So when you are issuing debt or taking debt, I think you have to keep that in mind. And the duration for which an entity can survive also becomes very important. But prima facie, it's about whether the borrower has the ability over time to repay the debt.
Understood. So debt is good provided you have the cushion of safety that, let's say, your income falls or the interest rate goes up, you are still able to repay it. Because then it provides leverage on your returns, right?
Yes.
Like if your return was, let's say, 10%, if you take debt, then it gets magnified to maybe 12% or 15%.
But on the downside, it can hurt you.
On the downside, it can hurt you even more. So debt increases leverage and it increases risk. And so if you have the cushion of safety and you're able to kind of pay back, then it's good. But otherwise, it may be problematic.
Correct. And what you're doing with it. So, for example, take Sri Lanka or Pakistan, right? Why are they in trouble? It is because they took on a lot of debt, built infrastructure, which was then not usable.
Right.
Right. So many local governments in China today are in trouble because they took on debt, built infrastructure. So, I mean, generally, on first principle, you would say that building of infrastructure is a good thing. But like apparently on the border with North Korea, there is a giant immigration hall where not even 1% goes for immigration. There is a massive flyover where there is no car.
Yeah.
And so if you take on that debt and build something which is unsustainable or is not going to give you the productive returns, then that debt becomes unsustainable. So that is what I would call bad debt.
Right. Great. So Nilkant, we'll move a little bit to debt taken by nations, and let's start from there, and then we move to corporates and individuals. So, if we think about countries, so what do they borrow for, and who do they borrow from? If you can throw some light on this.
See, what is the government? The government is just, or at least in the current state. I mean, there was a time when there were kings, and kings had thought very differently and acted very differently. But today, the state is effectively us, right? Collective us. Governments sometimes, actually these days seems like all the time, but it is supposed to be only sometime, where they want to spend more than what they can get in terms of taxes.
Right.
And the state, or that is the government, in principle can last forever. So it doesn't, I mean, unlike a human, which can die off and then who will take care of the debt, in the case of the government, the country will remain forever, potentially. So if you want to spend more for the future, basically, suppose you want to build infrastructure, which will be helpful to grow the economy. Like, say, if the National Highways Authority wants to, build a lot of highways, And there are these classic problems of, chicken and egg, where if you don't build the road, I mean, how will the traffic come? Because the economy won't grow. So in this case, what you do is you borrow and you build that infrastructure that allows the economy to flourish, because that road then creates more economic prosperity, and then taxes go up, and then road kind of pays for itself. So you're just time shifting, and this can only be done by the government,
right?
Because no one else can do it. So this is one reason why government should borrow. The second could be an investment in human assets. So you may not be, as a poor country, have the ability to invest in healthcare or education. But if you don't do that, 20 years later, you'll have a set of adults who are not healthy and who are not sufficiently trained and therefore not very productive. So you could actually borrow from the future, which is why you take debt. Then you basically spend it today in the hope that later on this becomes payable. When the governments think about it, and that's where the debt sustainability ratio, when people talk about debt to GDP, remember that both are moving parts. Mm. So long as your GDP is likely to keep growing, governments can keep on taking more debt, so long as their ratio is under control, right? Because the government is potentially for forever. And you are effectively, so who do you borrow from? In a given year, of course, you borrow from anyone who has a surplus. So as a saver, I can give money to a bank account or to a bank so that they can onward lend. The bank can then choose to lend to the government or the corporate. I can choose to directly buy Government of India bonds or any country's bonds. Or there can be foreign investors who can say that, look, this government is paying the best amount of interest, risk adjusted, and I don't see much risk with the currency, and therefore I want to buy this bond. So in that sense, the government is almost like any other borrower. The advantage they have is that they can potentially borrow for 100 years. Like, you know, Austria very famously issued a 100-year bond about a couple of years back. So you can borrow very long term. You can borrow at the lowest costs. And because it is the collective promise of the taxpayers, you can actually, if you use it productively, you can do wonders.
Right. Right.
Because individually, you and I cannot borrow at those kind of prices.
Correct.
But once the state promises that, look, I can, so then you get at capital at very low costs and for very long duration. So you can actually do wonders with it if you want.
Great. So Neelkant, why don't we take India as an example and just talk about, you know, how does this look for us as a country? How has it moved over time? And then what are we doing with the borrowing that that we are doing?
So let's take the central government and then, of course, the provincial government, the state governments also have their own budgets and their own deficits and all of that. This year, give or take, FY24, we will be, I think, spending about 47, 48 trillion rupees, lakh crores, about 18 trillion rupees, 18 lakh crores would be the fiscal deficit, and about 30 lakh crores is what the government expects in receipts.
Right.
So taxes, direct taxes, indirect taxes, all that. In terms of expenditure, so about 1/4 of that, about 24%, is interest. So effectively, all the debt that you have already taken, you need to pay, of course, service those savers. And so that's a very large cost. About 15% of the total expense is salaries and pensions. There is about, I would say, of the total expenditure, I would say about 3 trillion. So I would say 7-8% is defense, which includes the salaries and pensions of the defense personnel and all that. And some defense capex. About 10 trillion rupees, which is about 20%, is capex, basically spending on national highways, railways, and ports, and so on and so forth. And some capex for BSNL, you know, the 4G network for BSNL, and all that. So this is how broadly the government spends. The structure of how much the government should be allowed to borrow, right? Because see, what happens is, if the government borrows too much, because the government is also borrowing effectively in the same market as corporates are or individuals are. But as we discussed, the government, because of the very structure, is the first borrower, right? And is the first feeder. If the first feeder feeds too much, there's too little, left for the others. There's also a crowding out. So then the government, if it spends too much, it tends to crowd out. Now, are there caps? Can we put in place caps so that the government, because you're effectively spending other people's money,
right?
There's also tendency to be a bit casual about it,
yes.
right? That, I will give whatever free bus rides to someone, or this train ride is now free. Now, all of that may not be the best and productive use of capital. So there needs to be caps on what the government can spend. So even at the time of independence, when the Constituent Assembly was writing India's constitution, there was a group which wanted caps on government spending. But there was another group which said that, look, it is the sovereign. The sovereign needs to have flexibility. And that brings me to one point that I should have mentioned earlier. The government occasionally borrows from the future to smoothen out economic cycles. Mm. See, what happens when you're in a down cycle
yep.
is that people become scared, they reduce consumption, companies are too scared to invest, and therefore, the government then has to come in and supply that aggregate demand. So they borrow from the future, invest, the economy recovers, and you know things, so it smoothens out the economic cycle. Now, if it is a drought or a flood or some war, then if the government spending is capped, we might even lose the war. So that camp then said, no, there should not be any limits on government spending. So the compromise was that that at some point, the parliament will pass a law where the government is responsible to the parliament for a certain fiscal deficit ratio. And if right. they're not able to meet that, they'll have to explain why they can't meet it. So it's almost like, you know, a self-regulation that you... remember that this was done in 1950, the constitution was adopted. Till 2003, there was no regulation on fiscal responsibility. So 2003, if you remember, was the FRBM law, the Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act. And that's the first time that, and this also happened because after the, I think it was the Fifth Pay Commission, the government expenditure shot up
yep.
on salaries and pensions. And this was around the time when India had tried Pokhran, so there were problems.
And Kargil.
And Kargil war happened. And there was the Asian financial crisis.
Yep.
Exports were slowing. And then there was a dot-com bubble burst and the taxes were going down. So the government was really fiscally constrained. And that's when even the new pension scheme was launched. When the government realized that, oh God, that we have a defined benefit scheme for government employees and this is going to be absolutely unsustainable in a few decades. So that was when a lot of fiscal shocks, and remember that economy had started to open up, right, after 91. So that is when the first FRBM law was passed. But it took us a while to be really responsible in the sense that because after 2003-04, the taxes just took off because the economy was booming, global economy was doing very well. Actually, the fiscal deficit used to come in below what the government had targeted for most of these years.
Right.
They couldn't spend fast enough. There was so much tax coming in. But then when the financial crisis hit and governments, expenditure went up, taxes went down, and I think very unwisely, they nearly doubled government salaries in the Sixth Pay Commission. They gave us 65,000 crore loan waiver. And that really put a lot of fiscal stress or brought on a lot of fiscal stress. Around that time, the finance ministers every year would say, oh, you know what, we need to adhere to this target, but this year we cannot.
Correct.
That is all they needed to do, and they went ahead with it. Then around 2014-15, the FRBM review committee was set up, where they discussed that the problems with first-generation fiscal rules. And the first-generation fiscal rules, what India adopted in 2003 was attempted in the late 60s, early 70s in Europe and other developed markets. They were found to be pro-cyclical. So if you put a fiscal deficit target or cap, that you cannot have a fiscal deficit, say, above 3%, then in a down year or when the economy is going down, your taxes are falling, your expenditure can't be cut because a lot of it is interest and salary and pensions. Then you actually start curtailing discretionary expenditure that actually intensifies the downturn.
The downturn, correct.
So the second generation fiscal rules that have been adopted over the last 20-30 years target more medium-term objectives. So the FRBM review committee then gave a target of a debt to GDP.
Right.
That instead of targeting annual fiscal deficits, let's target a. But you know, different countries have adopted very different measures, and it's actually quite fascinating how federal governments split the debt responsibility between the center and the state, center and the provinces, the duration for which the budget management happens. Like India does it on an annual basis. You'll see that the US does it on a 10-year basis. So right. Whatever happens, there's a Congressional Budget Office, which then gives a 10-year budget projection. So different countries manage it differently. In India, I think versus a 60% debt to GDP target, and it was about 70-71% when this target was given. Because of COVID, we are well above it. So at the peak of COVID, or the year after that, we were at about 88-89%. And I'm talking consolidated, not just central government. Currently, we are at about 81-82%. We'll have to keep growing for a decade and keep bringing down our fiscal deficit annually for it to fall back to about 70% by 2032-33.
Right. So, Neelkant, there were many things you mentioned in your last response, and we'll pick all of them actually. Let's start with a very topical subject, which is this old pension scheme versus the new pension scheme, and you also mentioned it. So, to start with, can you just explain to us what is this, what is OPS, what is NPS, what are the implications of the two, and so on and so forth?
See, one of the biggest challenges for any society is how to take care of the retirees,
right,
of the old people. You can, and so therefore, broadly two types of, so pensions are what are supposed to help them in their retirement. So there are two types of pension benefits that you can provide. You can have a defined benefit scheme or a defined contribution scheme. A defined benefit scheme means that the organization, this used to happen with US automakers also, and they went bankrupt because of this. And therein lies a lesson as well for all of us. But mostly inside the Indian government, till 2000, people who joined before 2004, they are on a defined benefit scheme.
Right.
Which means that you can draw 50% of your last drawn salary at the time of retirement. And it is also inflation adjusted. So every time there is a pay commission, you know, every 10 years, there is a pay commission, and it allows for a pension adjustment in terms of payouts. So this is seen as something that can sort of protect people in their old age and provide them comfort.
So defined benefit, meaning that the benefit to the pensioner is defined.
Defined.
They get 50% of their salary.
Last drawn
till
salary.
Till they survive.
Inflation adjusted.
Till they survive. The benefit is defined. Whereas, I guess in the other case, the
defined contribution. So defined contribution scheme is you pay as you go while you are working. And there could be a sweetener from your employer, in which case it could be the government, or it could be the bank, or it could be whoever. So at the time of retirement, and so the new pension scheme is exactly that you keep depositing it, you have some flexibility, you want to deploy it in equity, you want to deploy it in debt, whatever, which fund, what type of fund and all that. And at the end of retirement, at the time of retirement, so when you are say 60 years old, you can then draw that out. You can deploy that into an annuity kind of scheme. So you put 100 rupees and you say draw 8 rupees every year so that your monthly expenses can be taken care of, or you can take out the lump sum, do something with it, right? So defined contribution schemes, as you can imagine, are much more predictable. The problem is that for the pensioner, all the risk then resides on. Like, for example, someone who retired in 2009 and thought that, say, a 30-40 lakh provident fund sum was sufficient, guess what? 5 years of inflation, and then suddenly that whole, the payouts today are abysmal.
Right.
Whereas if it had been, and the people who are on defined benefit schemes, because of inflation there, their payouts kept going up.
Now, if you lived longer, then in the defined benefit scheme,
100%.
It's fine because you get 50% of your salary.
Absolutely
annually.
Right.
But in defined contribution, there is a corpus and you kind of you know, run out
you
of
have
that
to spread it out over, and you're uncertain as to how long you're going to live.
Exactly.
So here the risk is completely on the pensioner. Now, this is why governments, you know, and especially given that the political leadership, and this is where I mentioned earlier, it's so easy to spend other people's money, right? Because it's taxpayers' money, so you do whatever you want to. And because the politicians are generally working together with the bureaucracy, so every day they are getting to hear only one side of the story. The challenge and the biggest problem with the old pension scheme is that while I think the objective of providing protection to old people is a very, very genuine one, and I think it has to be respected, the biggest problem is that you are providing it only to about 2% of the population.
Correct.
And in the process, what are very limited resources in terms of taxes, which should be used to educate young people, to make sure that they are healthy, are being deployed in just keeping some people comfortable. In fact, there is this view, and actually it's an observation, that you know, the biggest money lenders in rural Maharashtra are retired school teachers.
Right.
Because their pension, they're living in villages, their pensions are so large now that they become money lenders. So there is a distortion that this entails, which because of the silent majority, see, the 98% who are not getting this, they have no voice, or rather they don't even understand what this means. Whereas the 2% who stand to benefit from it are very vocal and are very, I mean, have the government's ear. Thankfully, given that in the recent elections, in the states where this was promised by the opposition, they still lost the elections, based on some of the public utterances of some leadership from that party, it does seem that this will now again go back to the back burner.
Right. And just to kind of put this into perspective, how much of a burden is this? I mean, burden is the wrong word, but if you think of it as percentage of expenses, etc., how much is for us pension expenses?
So for the state governments as a whole, it has already become as large as 8 to 9% of total expenditure.
Right.
For governments in total, it is about 40% of salary expenditure. And for governments in UP and Bihar, for example, so it is very distorted. For governments in UP and Bihar, the salary expenditure is now less than the pension expenditure.
Wow.
So what happens with the governments who have promised this, and you know, and as the life expectancy keeps rising, so even the assumptions made earlier on, if there were any assumptions made, my understanding is people just promised this without even doing a calculation on how much it costs in the future. The problem is that now you are paying, you are using precious taxpayer dollars to take care of a very handful of people who are also no longer working. So this can actually become a very large burden, and this keeps growing. See, I've been doing state budgets analysis for the last decade. You know, whether anything else grows or not, one aspect that keeps growing is the pension cost.
Right.
Because all states, so the center shifted to the new pension scheme after 2004. People have joined after that around defined contribution. States took a while. Some states have still not transitioned. And so by 2007-08, I think most states had done it. So for the next 20, 25 years at least, if not 30 years, the pension bill will keep rising nearly in double digits.
Right.
Because there's also an inflation adjustment that happens there.
Right. And while the NPS, the new pension scheme, is in force, but as we were discussing earlier, right now, the kind of everybody who's retiring right now is retiring as part of the old pension scheme.
Correct.
And that will continue for another at least 20, 30 years.
Yes.
And it's only after that the benefits of the NPS. So we will see this pension cost rise even further from the current levels. So yeah, so that was one kind of topic I want to kind of cover. The second one is this, the notion of the state finances versus central finances. And first, the difference between them, what is a state finance and what is a central finance? And secondly, what's happening here? Is there, I mean, are both moving the right direction? Is there something to do in one versus the other? How are things evolving?
See, this comes down to, at a very basic level, to how to run a country which is 17% of global population, right? So, You need to have a federal structure because there's so much disparity within the states, right? So there are states where kindergartens are being shut, schools are being shut because there are not enough kids. There are schools where fertility rate is still above 3. You have places with no water, there are places with abundant water, they have average life expectancy, average age is much higher, average is much lower. Some are industrial, like, you know, Tamil Nadu, industrial share of GDP is 45%, whereas agriculture share is in single digits, right? So because of this diversity, I think states need to have a lot more of fiscal freedom. And they need to be able to spend on what is important for them. So some states will want to spend and should be spending a lot more on irrigation, on drinking water. Some states which are much more urbanized need to spend on metro rail and all of that. So you need to have a lot of fiscal freedom that you need to give to the states. The second big difference between states is their level of per capita income.
Right.
And therefore their tax inputs. So for example, there are some states where nearly three-fourths of receipts are transfers from the center. And there are some states where it's only one-fourth.
Right.
Three-fourths are their own taxes. So for example, you know, where the real estate market is very important, like in Mumbai, Pune, Nagpur, etc. You know, property and stamp duty registration is a very big source of income. State governments or the developed states also have more SGST collection and so on and so forth. So therefore there is a lot of fiscal diversity. The way the Indian Union is structured, remember we are not a federation of states, we are a union of states, which means that the center is the primary, has primacy, and the center decides, so the states cannot break away even if they want to, it's a union of states. And so to a large extent, the state's ability to borrow has also been controlled. So under Article 293 of the Constitution, the state governments cannot borrow without the permission of the central government, so long as they owe money to the central government. So there was a time when only the center could borrow. The market for state governments to borrow didn't exist. Till the mid-90s, almost all the borrowing was done by the center, and then they would allocate the debt. So they would onward lend to state governments. So till 2026-27, almost every state government will have some exposure to or would have borrowed something from the center. Some of that will roll off, but this also includes loan guarantees. So for example, if you've taken JICA, which is a Japanese lender, and it has been guaranteed by the central government, even that will count for this. So the center can, as per the constitution, control how much a state government can borrow. So that is the mechanism through which it caps the fiscal deficit of the states.
Right.
So the state governments cannot have a fiscal deficit above 3% of GDP.
Right.
Unless the center allows it. So during COVID, for example, they said, okay, you can have a higher fiscal deficit if you want to, so long as you're doing it for capex, you're trying to support the economy or whatever. There is, at the central level, no cap. As we discussed, the FRBM law is a self-disciplining, self-regulatory kind of law. So the center can borrow as much as it wants and have as high a fiscal deficit as it wants. The problem with having too high a fiscal deficit is because crowding out. And if your debt to GDP becomes too high, the only way to service it is by inflating it away. What that means is that suppose your debt to GDP is, say, 100%. In India's case, it is about 81, 82, but suppose it is 100%, it's a nice round number. And suppose your fiscal deficit in a year is, say, 6%.
Right.
Now, unless your denominator is also growing at 6%, this ratio will keep growing, right? Now, the denominator growth has to be in nominal terms. Now, if you are a country like the US and your real GDP growth is 2%, and your fiscal deficit is, say, 7.5% at the federal level, unless you have 4 to 5% inflation, this ratio will keep going up. And nothing can keep going up forever, right? So at some point it becomes unsustainable. And so similar constraints apply to most governments. And the only solution to where the US is headed is to have structurally higher inflation. Because then you will keep the denominator elevated, and what is called financial repression, in the sense that the yield on government bonds will be kept artificially low and below inflation, and which means that the savers who have given money to the government will actually not be able to make the returns which can beat inflation, right? So it becomes a loss. So that is how. So it's like inflation is a slow default. Right, so you're refusing to pay because you can't.
Yep.
And so that is why sovereigns generally don't default. I mean, they
just print more money.
They print more money and cause high inflation, cause financial repression, and that's how they service it. So in India's case, I think the center clearly for the next decade has to keep its fiscal focus very strong. The quality of expenditure has to be maintained at a very high level. Remember that if your debt to GDP is very high, like it is in India, very aggressive fiscal consolidation can actually
make it worse,
because your denominator then starts to shrink or does not grow fast enough. And so therefore, you have to bring it down slowly, right? So it's like a sportsman who has sort of sprained a muscle. You cannot let it stay untouched, and you have to slowly bring it back to normal. At the state level, I think some of the states are in a decent position. So their debt to GDP, which as per the FRBM law, for the FRBM review committee, should have been at 20% on average. Some states are below that, 15-16%. Some states are at 28-30% as well.
Right.
And some of the states, like say Kerala, West Bengal, Punjab, their interest cost, salary and pensions are 60-65% of the total expenditure.
Wow.
So in a way, they have pretty much no capacity or very limited capacity to spend on infrastructure or improved healthcare or improved education for their people, because they have been somewhat profligate with their spending in the past, mostly because of a big conundrum, or not a conundrum. See, in India, despite very divergent debt to GDP ratios at the state level, debt to GSDP ratios at the state level, the cost of borrowing for various states is not very different.
Right.
And that is because of what is seen as an implicit government sovereign guarantee that the center will not let them default. Now, that has also meant that some of the states have actually been very irresponsible with their spending. And this recent new government that came up in Telangana, because there's also a lot of political thinking behind such statements, but they are saying that the coffers are running dry, that there's been so much of distribution of government revenues that there's nothing left to spend on productive things. So there are some states which I think are in a much worse position, but that will show up in the quality of expenditure rather than the quantity of expenditure.
Understood. Great. Very helpful. Nilkar, one final question on India before we move on to other countries. India borrows both domestically as well as internationally. No.
The sovereign does not have any foreign bonds.
Okay. And so any reason for this?
Oh, yeah. And the reason is that you do not want, it is, I think, the ignominy of what the state felt in 1991.
Right.
When you ran out of dollars and you had to pledge your gold, and you had technocrats coming in and advising the government and controlling your policy. So if you talk to anyone who was in the saddle around that time, their ears will go red thinking about it, right? So just the shame of having someone coming and advising you. So anyone of that era, and I think with the right reasons, has been very uncomfortable with allowing the sovereign to borrow abroad.
Right.
But they, as India has become more comfortable, and as the economy grows, you have to open up your capital account. I think allowing foreign investors to buy rupee bonds in India is something which is now, I think, very free. Right? I mean, it is possible now to do it. There's $300 billion of such loans, which bonds which they can freely buy. But Indian sovereign, because, you know, the moment you borrow in dollars, the Indian sovereign can then be sued in a foreign court.
Right.
And, you know, this was perhaps necessary at some point, it could have been necessary at some point when India was very short of dollars. But now that the balance of payment situation is much healthier, I think there is no need for India to also issue dollar bonds.
Great. That was an insightful conversation we had on debt, starting with a very interesting perspective on the history of debt, and with debt as a tool for distributing resources in a more productive manner in the economy. And hence we spoke about how if the debt can be used in a productive manner, then, you know, it can be a very positive tool. We also spoke about how the levels of debt, and hence debt being sustainable, is important, because debt increases risk. And so on the upside, it can give us more benefits. On the downside, it can hurt us more. And so we have to be covered for that risk. We spoke a little bit about the Indian government's debt profile and how we manage this both at the central level and the state level. And there we discussed two topical subjects. The first one was the old pension scheme versus the new pension scheme. And the second one was the central finances versus the state government finances. It's a very interesting topic. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. Thank you. Thank you for listening into this episode of Open Dialogue. I hope you enjoyed this as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. We are overwhelmed by the response that we've received and really look forward to your comments and feedback. Do like and subscribe to our channel to keep track of new episodes that are coming through. Thank you.